Have you ever had one of those situations where you went into something and you just knew that it wasn't going to go quite like you thought? Or at least it wasn't going to go quite like it should go. Like, you know, it should be planned out in a certain way. And you just know it. You know, you have that feeling in your gut. Maybe it's like a party or an event that you're planning. And on paper, it's all set up, but there's just like, I don't know about this. Or maybe it's something at work you're working on, or it might be, and it seems like no matter how much effort you put into it, or maybe a home project, and no matter how much research and planning, all that stuff, there's just like something you're like, I don't know about this. And you kind of just have that weirdness, that feeling in your gut. Well, believe it or not, there were even times, I believe, in Jesus's life that he was going into a situation and he knew that things should go this way, but more often than not, they did not go the way that they should. And there are many times I think that Jesus went into situations and thought, this could be a perfect opportunity. But I think he knew in his heart, I think he knew deep down, this was going to be another missed chance for people. Well, it was mentioned that in 2 weeks, Easter is going to be here. It's so wild to think that we are just running. We have run through winter. My daughter, Allie, she was counting down the days to spring, to yesterday. She would tell us, we've got 3 days until 1 week till spring. You know, like she was just ready for it, man. And so we're running up to Easter in just 2 weeks. And it's crazy to think that we're going to be there already. But today we're going to look at a situation in Jesus's life that as we lead up to Easter, as he led up to his crucifixion and resurrection, that it was a situation that really should have gone a different way than it did. Really, on paper, it should have been one of those moments that could have been really powerful, but unfortunately, the people, us, messed it up. Now, Easter, I would say, is sort of the pinnacle of the Christian faith because of what Jesus did on the cross for us. It's interesting that many times we kind of, I think about Christmas as like the central part of our faith, that it's just so important. And I think it is important, but I think a lot of it also has to do with our culture. You know, our culture gets on board with Christmas a whole lot more than they do with Easter. You know, we don't have on the radio a month's worth of Easter songs leading up to Easter, like Christmas, right? You know, we don't put in the Easter tree in our house and stuff. Now, let's be honest, maybe some of you just haven't taken down the Christmas tree and you're using that as an excuse that, oh, this is my Easter tree or whatever it might be. But if it wasn't for Easter, if it wasn't for Jesus going and dying and raising from the dead, then Christmas really wouldn't have meant anything. It would have been just another baby had come to the earth. But because of what Easter means to us, it means so much more. And I believe that as we kind of lead up to it, there are these moments that happen that I think could have been so much more, but unfortunately, they got missed out on. But the amazing thing is that as you look ahead to Easter, and as Jesus kind of looked ahead to where he was going, I don't think a lot of people around him really understood what all was going on. I don't think they really grasped the things that were unfolding in front of them, even though there were so many things pointing in that direction. You know, I think if you even go further back than when Jesus was on earth, I don't even think the Old Testament prophets truly and fully understood everything that was going to unfold, everything that was leading up to this moment. You know, for many centuries, many generations before Jesus came, the prophets would prophesy and tell about the Messiah's coming. And when they wrote those prophecies that God had given them, God speaking and working, his spirit working through them to write these things down, to bring about these prophecies, I don't think they fully understood what was going to happen. But God knew. God knew how things would play out. God knew the specifics. God knew the timing. God knew what was going to happen. Now, there's lots of debate about all of that right there, of what God knows and what God does and what God causes and what God lets and all these different things. And unfortunately, we don't really have the time to dig into that deep subject of what does God know versus what does God do and how does all that work together. We could kind of get caught up in that very easily. But I will say this as a note about it, an idea about it, that God knows all. Bottom line, God knows it all. He knows the things that are going to come in our lives. He knows the things that are going to happen in our lives. There is a certainty about that. And there are times in life that God does cause things to happen, but there are also times that God allows things to unfold and allows things to happen. But I think in this situation we're going to look at today, there was this moment that people didn't quite totally grasp what was going on. But God knew. God knew that he would eventually send his son, Jesus. He would send him to earth for him to live and to serve and to teach and to heal and to eventually to die and to raise from the dead. But I'm sure that when the prophets of the Old Testament, when they were writing these things down, they probably didn't totally understand all of that. You know, in fact, there are even times that the prophets would write things down, would write prophecies, or they would speak prophecies, and sometimes they had direct application to the situations that were going on. Sometimes the prophets would talk about things, and it had a specific application that was going on in that day, but it also pointed to something further on that would happen later on. That's kind of what we would call a type in the Bible. There were these different types all throughout the Bible, things that they had direct application, but it was sort of a picture. It was a foreshadowing of something greater to come. Jonah was a type. He spent 3 days in the belly of the fish, almost to kind of symbolize and to signify the coming Messiah who would spend 3 days in the tomb. Moses, he was a type of the Messiah who would come to lead God's people to the promised land, to lead us to our promised land. You may even remember that one of the situations within the Israelites and Moses leading them, that God sent snakes and they bit whenever they were venomous snakes, and anyone that they bit would die from their venom. But he told Moses, if you put a snake up on a pole and you put that in the middle of the camp, anyone who looks at the snake up on that pole would be healed. And us today, that was even a type pointing ahead to the one that we look to, who was hung on a cross. And when we look to him, we find healing and forgiveness. There's all these different things that, even though in the Old Testament, even though in their days, these things took place and had specific purpose and meaning, they also were pointing ahead. But then I think there are also even other things that when those prophets said them, when those prophets wrote them down, people kind of stood there and scratched their head and they're like, what are you talking about? What I don't understand what this means. But they knew, and God knew, because he was pointing ahead to the Messiah would come. Like an example we can find in Isaiah chapter 53 and verse 2. It says this, he grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain. Like one from whom people hide their faces, he was despised, and we held him in low esteem. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. This passage points to Jesus, who would one day, generations and generations after these words were spoken and written, that Jesus would one day come and would take that punishment upon him for us. Or even in the book of Psalms, there was a passage that when Jesus was hanging on the cross, you may remember that he cries out to God, and he quotes this passage from Psalm 22, verse 1. It says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from my cries of anguish? Now, some people will say that when Jesus said this, when Jesus cried out in this way, it was because that God turned his back on Jesus. I do not think that's the case at all. And a lot of times we'll say that God turned his back on Jesus because, you know, God can't look upon sin. And there are passages in the scriptures that say that. But I believe that is a whole lot more metaphorical than literal. Because there were times that God came face to face with people who were sinful. God spoke to Moses face to face, who had sin in his life. There was even the situation, it's recorded in the book of Job, that Satan himself stood in the presence of God. And what's more is that God looks upon us all the time. You see, I believe that when Jesus said these words, what was happening was that he was calling to mind for these people that were there around him. He was calling to their mind so that when they heard him say these words, those Jews that were there, maybe even those religious leaders who know these words, who know this song that was written generations and generations and generations ago, that when he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? That they would pause and they would remember the rest of that psalm. Let me read some more of that to you. In verse 14, I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart has turned to wax, and it has melted within me. You remember the situation where the soldier comes and pierces Jesus' side, and it says that water flowed from there. It was almost as if his heart had melted. Or in verse 15, my mouth is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. You remember that Jesus even said, I am thirsty. You see, these things that were happening, Jesus was trying to call to their attention the fact that this was planned. Jesus is trying to call their attention to the fact that I'm up here on purpose. He's calling their attention back to this. You see, Jesus came to die. Make no bones about it. He was there on purpose. This wasn't a mistake. This wasn't something that was just kind of God just sort of let it unfold. Well, I guess we'll roll with this and see what happens. No, this was God's plan, and generations and generations and generations before, long before, all the way back to the very beginning, God set this plan in motion, and God designed this plan, and this was an opportunity for Jesus and many other different times for him to call people's minds back to these prophecies, these things that were pointing ahead to him of what would happen. And so today, we're going to look at a passage in Luke. We're going to look at a passage of where I believe it's kind of leading up to the climax of the death of Jesus and leading up to it. And this has become known as the triumphal entry, is what we kind of refer to it as. And this actually happens on Palm Sunday. And I know that typically you preach about Palm Sunday on Palm Sunday, and next Sunday is Palm Sunday. And that's okay. It really doesn't matter that way. I think there's actually something else I want us to look at next Sunday on Palm Sunday. There's something that happened between Jesus' triumphal entry and his resurrection that I want us to see next week. And so today, we're going to look at actually him coming into the city of Jerusalem. And we're going to look at this in four different segments, four different things that happened there that hopefully will kind of give us some important lessons about this plan of God's. And the first thing is that it was Jesus' unique entrance. He had a unique entrance when he came into the city of Jerusalem. He came in there a few different times, but this time was very unique. And so we're going to pick up in Luke chapter 19 in verse 28. It says, after Jesus had said this, he went on ahead going up to Jerusalem. As he approached Bethphage and Bethany at the hill called Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples saying to them, go to the village ahead of you. As you enter it, you will find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, why are you untying it? Say, the Lord needs it. Those who were sent ahead went and found it just as he told them. As they were untying the colt, its owners asked them, why are you untying the colt? They replied, the Lord needs it. They brought it to Jesus, threw their cloaks on the colt, and put Jesus on it. As they went along, people spread their cloaks on the road. Now, this is a very unique way for somebody to come into a city, especially for Jesus. Again, he had been there many times. This wasn't the first time Jesus came to Jerusalem. But every other time, though, he had walked in. Like everybody else, just kind of walked into town. But this time, he tells his disciples to go and get this animal, to go and get this donkey or the colt of a donkey. He tells them to go and get this young donkey for him. And Jesus' disciples bring it to him. And they go in there and they find it. And the owner's like, what in the world's going on? And he tells them what's happening and he brings it. And this might seem odd to us when we look at this and say, why would you choose a donkey to ride on? When I was a kid, my grandmother lived on a farm in Harrisonburg out in the western part of the state. And we'd stay out there. And it was this old farmhouse and it didn't have air conditioning. So in the summer months, you know, you slept with the windows open. And there was a donkey just up the road. And let me tell you, that donkey was the alarm clock. And we would hear him hee-hawing all morning long at the crack of dawn, or what it felt like the crack of dawn as a little kid. But why in the world would you choose to ride on this animal? But once again, we see that this was on purpose. This was a part of his plan. You see, what might seem odd to us, and might even have seemed odd to the disciples, but maybe not when you stop and think about it, because the disciples probably got used to these odd requests, right? Because over and over, Jesus was kind of telling them to do what seemed like odd things to them. Like when there were thousands of people listening to Jesus, and Jesus said, give them something to eat. And they're like, what? How are we supposed to feed thousands of people? And then he says, well, bring that little boy's lunch to me, and now go take and feed everybody. And they're like, how are we supposed to feed thousands of people with this small lunch? Or when they were out fishing one time, and they caught nothing, and then Jesus, the carpenter's son, says, hey, go back out and put in the deep water and put your nets down. And they thought, okay, I guess we'll trust this guy. And they did it, and they find a huge catch. And so he sends his disciples to get this donkey. This weird request, at least it seemed weird to them. But the reason he did this is that it was going to signify something. You see, when a king would leave town, when he was going off to war, a king would ride a mighty horse and would look very powerful up on his mighty steed there, and he would ride out to battle. But when the king would come back after victory and after bringing peace, well, he would ride back in on a donkey. And so Jesus here was symbolizing and saying to everybody that he was their king coming in and bringing peace. And not only that, but it was also fulfilling what was written in Zechariah 9:9. It says, rejoice greatly, daughter Zion. Shout, daughter Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, victorious and righteous and victorious, lowly and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. You see, it may have just seemed like in some ways, on the surface, like just an odd and unique way to travel, but truly it had purpose and it had meaning as Jesus arrived there. Let's look at the next section now in Luke 19, verse 37 now. When he came near the place where the road goes down the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples began joyfully praising God in loud voices for all the miracles they had seen. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to Jesus, teacher, rebuke your disciples. I tell you, he replied, if they keep quiet, the stones will cry out. So here Jesus, he's beginning his journey, his coming into the city, and his disciples are starting to praise God for him. Now, real quick, we haven't really touched on this whole, the issue of this term disciples. You know, many times we kind of get the words disciples and apostles kind of mixed up and used interchangeably, but truly there were 12 apostles. There were 12 men who were with Jesus that stayed with him all of the time. They lived with him, they ministered with him, they did everything with him. But then there were the disciples who were all of his followers. Everyone who follows Jesus is a disciple. And so here we have a crowd of his followers who were there and who were probably being joined by other people who saw him coming in. And what happens is that the people celebrate Jesus. And this is key for us to kind of keep in mind that in this moment right here, they're celebrating Jesus. They're excited about Jesus. Blessed is the King. They're so excited about their King coming in because they were thinking that Jesus was there to take over the throne, to take over the government. And as a king may have done and may have come in and toppled this government. It's interesting because all throughout history, God's people keep on looking for the wrong kind of king, keep on looking for the wrong kind of leader in that way. I mean, you could go all the way back to the Garden of Eden. In Genesis 3, we find the fall of man where God tells Adam and Eve, look, you can have everything. Everything is yours except this one thing. Don't touch the fruit of this tree. Don't even come near it. Don't touch it. And what happens? Well, they decide that God would not be their king, but that they would be their king. We see in verse 6 in chapter 3, when the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some of it and ate it. And she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. You see, in this moment, man made themselves king. And it was about us being in charge. Or even if you go later, God's people are crying out and they're wanting a king. And in 1 Samuel 8:5, it's recorded of how they say it. They say, now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. They sound kids, right? Well, so-and-so's got one. Why can't we have one? And they want a king like everyone else. They want a governing king. In fact, God even says to Samuel, they've rejected me as their king. And they want a king like everyone else. And even here, as Jesus comes into Jerusalem, as he comes in this moment, they miss what all of this means. They see Jesus as this conquering king, ready to topple the government instead of being this king of peace. But the people celebrated Jesus because of what they thought he was going to give them, because of what they thought they were going to get out of him, of what they thought that they were going to profit from him. And we do this today still. You know, we're so quick to come to God when we think we're going to get something from him. We're so quick to name him the king when we think he's going to profit us, when he's going to make things good for us. But how quickly do we turn on him? You know, and not to be the spoiler, but we already know what happens. But in just a few short days, these people are going to turn on Jesus. The ones who are shouting, praise him, are going to be the same ones who are going to shout, crucify him. And we do the same thing many times. You know, things are going along in life so well. Things are good. Maybe family's good. Family's healthy and happy. Job's good. You know, things are kind of clicking along well. Our personal life maybe is good, and we're praising God. God is so good. God is so wonderful. Everything's happening so well. But then the moment something goes wrong, God, why are you doing this to me? God, why are you causing me to go through this? God, why is my life like this? Why are you sending me this way? And we just over and over want to call out, almost crucify him all over again. We're so quick to worship him when we think there's something in it for us, just like these people. They thought this king was coming for them. Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's go on to verse 41 now. As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it and said, if you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes. The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not realize the time of God's coming to you. You see, so much led up to this moment, this point in time, so much prophecy, so much timing, so much of leading up to what should be a powerful moment of peace and of joy. But you know what happens instead? We find that Jesus weeps for the people. He weeps for them. This is actually one of only two places that we see in Scripture where Jesus breaks down in such emotion. The other time was at the grave of his friend, his dear friend Lazarus, when he finds out his friend has died and they show him the tomb and he weeps. But why is he weeping here at this moment? I mean, they're all there cheering him on, right? You'd think this is a great moment, but he says, if you'd only seen truly what's really is going on here, if you had only paid attention, if you'd only put things together and understood what's really happening here, I'm not here to conquer like you think I am. I'm not here to be a warrior king for you. I'm actually here to die for you as a sacrificial lamb. And he knows what they are missing. He knows what's going on. And sadly, this isn't the first time that they missed all of this. In fact, one of the last times that Jesus was in Jerusalem before this, a similar thing happened. While he was there, the Pharisees actually come and tell Jesus that Herod wants to kill him. Now, if you ask me, the reason that Herod probably wants to kill him is that the Pharisees were probably feeding him a lot of lies because the Pharisees weren't too much fans of him. But it says in Luke 13:34. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you are not willing. Jesus says, I just want to care for you. I just want to come in and bring you peace and hope, but you keep pushing me away. And that time he left, but this time Jesus won't leave the city this time. Now he will stay there for his final week. This time, Jesus will go there, he'll stay, and he'll die. And so he sees people, he sees these people around them and how they're cheering his name and they're excited to see him in one moment, but he knows what's coming later in that week. He knows how they'll turn on him, and he weeps. He weeps for that. He weeps over that city. You see, Jesus sees their hearts. He sees what's going on below the surface. He knows what's truly going on. Over and over again, we've seen situations where Jesus knows what's really happening in people's hearts. Even though they're singing his praises outwardly, even though they're saying these great things about him, even though they seem to be excited and really excited about him being there, but their hearts seem to be against him. In fact, in Matthew 15:8, he says, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. And that's a scary thing, friends, to honor God with our lips, but our hearts to be far from him. That's exactly what's happening here in this moment with these people. They're saying praises to God. They're singing praises to God with their mouth, but their hearts are far, far from him. What about you? What about us? You know, maybe we even come here sometimes on Sundays, and maybe we even lift our voices in songs and we sing these words and they're so wonderful and the melody is so beautiful. Maybe we even close our eyes in worship at times and just picture ourselves with our Father. Maybe we even raise our hands to Him to try and worship Him. But then maybe tomorrow, or maybe even later today, those same mouths are full of lies or cruel and hateful and hurtful words. And maybe instead of closing our eyes in worship, maybe what we begin to do is fill our eyes with images or things that begin to degrade people and the way we perceive people, and we pretend that sin is entertainment for us. Or maybe instead of lifting our hands in worship of God anymore, maybe we use them to strike someone, or we use them to participate in the misuse of our bodies that God has given us. You see, Jesus saw their hearts, and He knew how quickly that they would turn. And He sees our hearts too. And He knows what goes on, and He knows what's happening. And I wonder how many times that He's looked at us the same way He looked at Jerusalem, and He's wept over us, and He just says, if you would just pay attention to what I'm trying to do. But as terrible and as heartbreaking as this is, the betrayal of theirs and the betrayal of ours is, it doesn't stop Jesus. You see, Jesus still went to the cross. Jesus displays His great love for them and for us, in that He knows that these people are going to betray Him. He knew that you and I would one day do the same thing. That one day we'd be praising His name, and then on the next day we'd be disgracing His name in our selfish sin. And I love what John records in John 15:13, that Jesus says, greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. He says, you are my friends if you do what I command. You see, Jesus loved them enough, and He loves us enough, that He would see their betrayal in their eyes, and He would still go to the cross. We even see in John's gospel how Jesus knew of Judas's betrayal. He knew that Peter would deny Him. He knew that the apostles would desert Him. And He still humbly served them at the night of the Last Supper together. He washes their feet, and He still goes to the cross even after that moment. But that's because that's why Jesus came. And they should have known, but they missed it. And friends, you and I, we don't have that same excuse of ignorance. Now, we can look back over history. We can look back into the scriptures. We know why Jesus came. We know that He came and He died and that He rose again just for us. Now, how are we going to respond? I was sitting in the back listening to Troy's community devotion this morning, and it was I couldn't help but think of one of my favorite movies, Saving Private Ryan. It's a great movie. There's a scene at the end of that movie where the main character, Tom Hanks. Now, look, the movie's been out for a long time. Big spoiler alert, okay? So I'm just sorry. If you haven't seen it yet, I'm going to ruin it for you. That's okay. Tom Hanks is sitting there, and he's actually been wounded. He's been shot, and he's sitting there on a bridge. And the battle has ended. They've won. Their reinforcements are coming in. They've saved Private Ryan. And that private that so many men have gone and searched out for and died to find, to send home, because his other two brothers have already died in the war, and the government wants to send him home. Well, he comes over to Tom Hanks, the leader of their platoon, and Hanks pulls him in, his character pulls him in, and he says, earn this. Earn this. Now, he knows that Ryan could never earn the sacrifice that all these people gave for this one guy. But he knows, as Troy was talking about earlier, that he could live a life that would honor the sacrifice. And friends, I believe that Jesus sometimes wants to grab us by the collar and pull us in and say, look, earn this. Not earn your salvation and the wonderful things you do, but man, live a life of the calling that He's put on our life. And I think He wanted to, almost as He walked down that road and coming into Jerusalem, He probably wanted to grab onto the robes of the people around Him and say, come on, earn this. Friends, we have got to be able to open our eyes and see the things that are happening around us and how much He loves us and what He has done for us, and not continue to, in one moment, praise Him and love Him and sing His wonderful name, but then in the next moment turn around and curse him. We have a blessing of seeing clearly of what they were confused about, but we see it clearly that Jesus came and he died and he rose again for you and I to save us.